I don't know what happened.
Gone.
Yay! Well, hey everybody, my name's Andrea.
Hi.
And I'm an alanonic, which means I can drink safely, but I've totally been affected by alcoholism. And thank you so much. This is so exciting. I've always wanted to be Heidi. I used to watch it on the TV when I was little, and now I'm here, and it's awesome. And the convention's about easy, does it? And I thought I'd share to begin with about step zero to one. And that's anything but easy, does it, in my story. So I don't have brothers and sisters, and I grew up for the first 7 years with my mum and dad in the same house. My dad was completely deaf, and he also had acute mental illness and a lot of psychotic episodes. Wasn't alcoholic, did like a lot of prescription meds. And there used to be a weird sitcom in the UK, some of you may be aware of it, some not, called Some Mothers Do Have 'Em. And it used to scare the living daylights out of me, because it was just like my mum and dad. The father, completely ineffectual, needing a lot of caretaking, and a very docile, passive wife. And I hated that programme, and then they had a baby. And I just felt awful for this kid in a cot, because I felt exactly the same. So there was an awful lot of neurosis going on in the house, and my mum came from a line of untreated Al-Anons. And I had a grandfather and a great-grandfather. I didn't know either of them, but they were both alcoholic. So there was an awful lot of alcoholism, but they were also, on my mum's side, part of a religious cult, which I had to be part of. So I thought that's what the problem was. So when I got to 16, I was like, I'm out of here. I'm going to art college and I'm going to party. That's what I'm doing. I'm out. This is the end of my childhood, which I thought had ended at about seven anyway. I remember my daughter's step-grandmother having a child. And when that child turned seven, I at that point was 22, 23, and I said to her, aren't you really sad your daughter's now grown up? And she said, what? What do you mean she's grown up? I said, she's seven. She's now grown up. She went, she's really, really not a grown up. And I just thought, you have no idea. But that was my perception, that childhood finished very rapidly. And so I'll fast forward, because there's a lot to share with you. I ended up going to art college, going through all that whole system. And I lived at one point with a boy. He was about 18, I was 17. He turned up at my flat saying, I can't trust you, so I'm going to move in. And I went, okay. Didn't want to say okay, meant no, but here's the beginning of a pattern. And we went to art college, we went through all that whole thing. I found him really boring, very controlling. And all he wanted me to do was watch political programmes in the evening, question time, so boring. And he wanted me to collect all my bank statements and keep them in the folder that the bank provided. And I just thought, I can project my entire life with you. I'm not doing it. So I was on the lookout for him. Not this one, but a different him. But I didn't have the courage or the clarity or the strength to be on my own. So I wouldn't just be upfront and say, this isn't for me, I'm out. It's like, but then I lose all his friendship group and the flat. So I had my own self-seeking motives for that, to stay with him. But anyway, we lived in this house in London, and the house had been divided into these flats. And there was a communal telephone by the front door that none of us paid for, but we had a number so people could call. And I'd had my degree show, I'd put out little business cards with my number on. And so my degree finished on the Friday, and on the Monday, I had no plan for life. I don't know how old I was at this point. Yeah, 21. No plan for living, just reacting to everything. And I went to leave to go into my mum's office in London to use her typewriter to send some letters. And I thought, don't go, the phone's going to ring. So I sat on the stairs and waited for the phone to ring. And it did. It rang 15 minutes later, and this woman said, oh, hi, my name's Elaine, and I'm doing a project at a film school, and I'd love you to come out and be a volunteer on it. Oh, that sounds amazing, but actually, I don't drive. and I live in Clapham and I don't drive. And she said, I live in Clapham as well, I can come and pick you up in 20 minutes. Okay, I mean, absolutely reckless, but I thought I was sort of living in the spirit of things. So 20 minutes later, I'm in her van. I don't remember calling my boyfriend, so by the way, when you come back, the flat would be completely empty, and I'd gone off to Buckinghamshire, miles away from where we live. Didn't occur to me. So I got taken to Buckinghamshire, walked into this film school, and was introduced to some members of staff, and there was a very angry-looking guy there, long hair, and engraving some props, and he looked furious, and he was in a dark corner of this film studio. And I just thought, whoa, he looks really angry. I'll give him a wide berth. Because I'm, you know, living in London, wearing hot pants, makeup, having a great time. And I just thought, I don't really need to be around that. Well, within 4 days flat, I was completely obsessed with him. Because he didn't like me, clearly. And I equated people that didn't like, who didn't like me as healthy. Because I didn't feel healthy on the inside. Because I knew what I'd grown up with and I knew how my thoughts were. So he didn't like me, so then the challenge is on. I need to get this person to like me. He had a girlfriend that was also a member of staff. That was annoying because, you know, obviously I needed to be with him. I thought he looked like a French poet. I don't know what a French poet looks like. I realise now what he looks like is an untreated alcoholic and a drug addict. But I didn't think that at the time. So we got into this situation that I forced. I was completely obsessed with him. And it's interesting that my daughter recently called me and she said, Mum, was Dad drinking when you met him? And I said, yeah. I said, yeah, he was drinking about a bottle of vodka a day. And so was I was having half a bottle of vodka a day. It was what everybody did. We were young, 21. He was 24. And I just said, why do you ask? And she said, because he said when you met him, he wasn't drinking at all. And he had never drank. And actually, you thought, and you said to him, he was really boring. And that he'd be really fun if he drank a lot. And so that's why he started drinking. And that didn't work. He weren't happy with that. So he turned to outside issues. And that was the problem. And I just said to him, that's news to me. And I don't go with boring ones. I wouldn't pick a boring one and hang around to hope they would suddenly become fun. They'd be dumped. So this is his rationalisation still. That I was the cause of his drinking. So, anyway, his girlfriend found out that I was seeing him, and she called me and just said, I know about you, and he doesn't want to leave me, and he doesn't want to leave you, so would you move in with us? Okay, I mean, my answer to everything was, yeah, okay, whatever, I can do it, because what I need is him, and this is a way in, this is like fast track, I'm now going to be right in the thick of it. You're going to go, you don't know that yet, but once I'm in, I'm in. And that's what happened. She left after 6 months. And my first thought was, oh God, don't leave me with him. Because by that time he'd resigned. He'd resigned from his job, so he ditched that. And I'm like, oh no, I had a plan. And you were kind of a reason that, you know, this was all prestige and property and money and career and all the rest of it. And the writing was on the wall the day I met him. They were going through the costume box and dressing up to go on a staff pub crawl, and he chose the outfit of a tramp. That was his idea of fun, to go out drinking. His idea is he doesn't drink until he met me. But anyway, this was chaos. He also, at that point, had his first love of his life was still on the scene. And the reason she was still on the scene was she was his first cousin. This should have been a warning to me, but I turned what we call a red flag into a red bouquet, and I thought, no, this is fine. This is just bohemian. I can do this, I'm creative, I can do bohemian. There was a fly in the ointment that she was actually dying of AIDS, which terrified me. And by this time, I'm pregnant. And I'm like, okay, this is all beginning to get really nuts. I've left the boyfriend, the boring one with the bank statements and question time, he's long gone, I'm now with this one. Pregnant, and his girlfriend, first girlfriend, love of his life, had, was dying. We went to see her one day, and she said to me when he was out in the kitchen making a cup of tea, I've just started going to Al-Anon because I've realised I only go out with alcoholics, and he's an alcoholic. And I just thought, you're nuts. And by the way, you're going to be dead soon, and I really don't like what you're saying to me, and I don't like it that you sit in the front seat of the car with a seatbelt on, and I'm pregnant in the back in a car without seatbelts, and I don't see why, because you're about to die. This is what I'm thinking. But you would never know I was thinking that. Total people pleaser, fake smile, willing helper, changing her medical lines. I've no medical training at all. Dealing with blood, terrified, didn't talk about it, and his family would say to me, "You're such a saint." And the thing for an Al-Anon, untreated Al-Anon, pity and sympathy is absolutely what's going to kill any of us. But at that point, that kind of pity that I was experiencing would really set me apart from everybody in a very bad way. Because what they were really saying is, "I wouldn't put up with any of this that you're dealing with. And we're really judging you for doing it, and we're judging your choice." And I thought, I don't want to be doing any of this anyway. This is all getting out of hand rapidly. So I went through 11 years, had the baby, that didn't sort him out. Went through a whole ton of trying to control his drinking, because his drinking began to reveal itself rapidly. And it was progressive. And I began to really try techniques to control his drinking. So I'd be like, "When we go out, please don't drink Rioja. If you drink whiskey, I'm not even going anywhere near you. How about Guinness? Because that's kind of like food. And I'll feed you bread and butter before we go out. And then when we get there, just keep your eyes on me all night, and I'll remind you when it's time to drink water." I mean, what a fun night out for me. You know, like, I'll just go out and be your chaperone. Of course, we'd get there and he'd be gone. And I'd be like chatting with people going, "Yeah, that's really interesting, talking about the school panda. I really don't care what you're... Where is he? What's he doing?" We went to a school barbecue. He told my daughter's new teacher to... It really swore at him about to go away. And I just remember thinking, the shame for me that I was with this guy was off the chart. He was no longer some cool French poet. He was a maniac, unemployed and drunk and asleep a lot of the time. And I had a baby. So we did this 11-year madness. Geographics, I mean, there's so many stories I could say. But every time there was a big fight, there was always a big fight, he would fake remorse and come back. And there was one particular time we'd had a huge fight. He'd gone off and slept with somebody else that I'd said yes to, meant no. Dealt with that in my fourth and fifth step. But he turned up, and there was a knock at the door, and he turned up with a tape cassette. And I opened the door, because I'm dying inside, the fact that I'm now bringing up my daughter for like 10 minutes on my own. 10 minutes felt like a lifetime. I can't do this on my own. What if he gets well? Somebody else gets the benefit of that after all I've put up with, and I don't want to watch that going on. So anyway, he gave me his tape cassette, and it was Jeff Buckley singing Hallelujah. I hate that song. But he handed me this cassette and he said, "You're a broken hallelujah and I broke you. Come on in." I mean, talk about inviting in a vampire. I didn't say, "Well, hang on a minute, I'm busy," or "Call me tomorrow if you want to have a conversation and we'll talk about what you've actually done, not what you said." And I was sharing in the meeting earlier, you know, somebody said to me in Al-Anon, "We don't watch anything they do. We just listen to everything they say, and conversely, they don't listen to anything we say, they just watch what we do." So I went through this process for 11 years. And I ended up with there was such a big blackout event where he smashed up the kitchen, the police were called, the neighbours thought we were being burgled, I'd escaped to his parents' house with my then 2-year-old son because one baby didn't sort it out, so two, Mike, that didn't. And it was absolute chaos. A baby in the family died. Everything started unravelling rapidly. Not my baby, but first cousin to my son and daughter. And I had my first surrender, and that was in a bathroom. Violence going on downstairs. I could hear him beating his mum up. She was screaming. I had a baby in a cot. My daughter was somewhere else, thank God, being looked after. And I caught sight of myself in this bathroom mirror, and I was as white as a sheet with dinner plate eyes. And I remember thinking, I don't think this is how I should feel about the father of my kids. I don't think this is right. I couldn't equate it was anything to do with alcoholism, because he told me it was nothing to do with drinking. The problem was me, how I looked, my attitude, my mouth, my neurosis around my parents. You know, he'd always say, "Oh, you're just like your mother." I mean, it would just go on and on. But it became so unmanageable, I called the police and got rid of him. And on the Monday, Tuesday morning, oh, by this time I got rid of everybody I knew and my family, isolated, done a geographic to live by the coast, and I now worked for his family. These are all solutions, I thought, to try and manage active alcoholism. So I got to work in the morning, and it was an open plan office, and his stepdad's there and his mum's somewhere, I don't know. And I just remember thinking, I've lost everything. I've lost my dreams, my hope. I'm terrified. I've got two children. I'm trapped. I live by the sea. There's only one way out of here. He's now somewhere trying to get sober with his friend who's a drug and alcohol counsellor who had a severe drug problem himself, and nobody would talk about it. And I'd be like, the emperor's not got any clothes on. Paul is off his head. Paul committed suicide last year. And my first thought was drugs, obviously. And everyone's saying, no, it's a heart attack. Anyway, that was the reality of what was going on. And I got to work that morning and I just thought, I wonder if it's anything to do with alcohol. I don't know, but something really crazy is happening in my life and I'm absolutely terrified. And so I pulled up Al-Anon on the computer, turned the computer monitor away from everybody, and there were the 20 questions immediately. And I started answering them, and I answered 19 out of 20, and then saw the bit about if you answer three, then Al-Anon could be for you. And that was my first surrender. I hadn't surrendered the relationship completely. There was still, I hadn't conceded to my innermost self that this was bad, and I was really ill. That didn't come into it. It was just, I wonder if there's anything to do with booze. So a lot of that was not easy, does it? I was forcing a solution. Step zero just went on for so long. It'd been going on for my entire life. And he was a catalyst that kind of brought it all out into the open. So then easy does it begins to appear in this first meeting. And I was taught about the four M's of Al-Anon. And that's managing, manipulating, mothering, and martyrdom. And I'd grown up with all these women that did all that. They were all the breadwinners, and the men were either dead or nuts or alcoholic or in psych wards. You know, there weren't any male role models that I could see that were healthy at all. So off I go to Al-Anon, and I'm beginning to hear things about God's will and self-respect. I had grown up in a cult. I was having nothing to do with God, nothing. And thank God nobody said, you need to believe this, because I would have walked straight out of the door and you'd have a different speaker here this evening. But I started going to Al-Anon. I went for 8 years and did an awful lot of service and no step work. That's quite a dangerous combination because I didn't know anything about me. I hadn't really used the steps to apply them to my own real life, what happened on that holiday, in that sitting room, in that bedroom, in that outfit. None of that had come into it. But I had got enough self-esteem and self-respect to begin to think, right, I am going to leave this relationship. And after the most unmanageable weekend possible, there was no easy does it in that weekend. I had booked 5 different things all happening on the same weekend, and all of them were big and none of them could move. And the adrenaline of just keeping on piling it on was enormous. This involved taking after other people's children, doing an exhibition, doing a school fair at Christmas, wearing an apron, baking 15 litres of pancakes, getting it all over the car. My apron smelled of fish. I lost both children. He went into a blackout with a private view, saw everybody, the room emptied. I mean, it was just absolute madness. And I had this rock bottom in front of a Smeg fridge, which made it even worse, because I always wanted a Smeg fridge and I couldn't afford one. And these things just compounded everything. But I began to take actions that were easier than fighting alcoholism. And, you know, I've heard it said, you know, the easier, softer way. The easier, softer way is not being in the illness. The painful way is actually going through the steps, but then the pain stops. I was doing it and the pain just kept coming back and back and back. So I moved house. I got rid of him. He went to get the flat next door. That's another long story. I won't go into all of it. But I moved with my son and daughter, still to the same town. And what it did was gave me access to a whole bunch of new meetings. And I went to a meeting in Brighton, and somebody there was talking about a speaker I'd heard online called Mary Pearl. And I really wanted to go and see her. and they said that there was a Serenity weekend in Glasgow happening. I bought a ticket immediately after that meeting and went there. And on the Saturday, I turned up late because I was people-pleasing my other Al-Anon friend, who was a bit slack in getting out of the flat quick. And I ended up sitting in the second row. And I couldn't see Mary Pearl, because this woman in front of me had a massive hairdo. And I started getting really resentful, thinking she needs to cut her hair off or tie it up. I could tell her how to change her behaviour so I get a nice result for myself. No responsibility or accountability to the fact I was late. Anyway, I moved my chair in the break. That was the action I could take. I'm moving my chair. And I ended up moving it, and I ended up sitting next to Hamish, who I'd never met before. I thought everybody in Scotland who was a man was called Hamish, and he proved me absolutely right. I've only met one other person called Hamish. But after a while, we kept in contact, and Hamish asked me if... He said, I'd really like to court you traditionally if that's acceptable to you. And I thought, I've read that merry-go-round of denial leaflet about turning the sound off so you can see what people are really doing, not what they're saying, what's he doing? And I said, yes, that would be acceptable to me. On paper, you'd look at it and think, right, she's come out of an 18-year train wreck. But I'd left that relationship in 1996. This is 2009. I just didn't have the courage to follow through with it and do it all. But emotionally, I was done with the whole thing. So I met Hamish, but we were long distance. He's in Scotland, I'm down near London. There's about 500 miles in between. And I threw myself into recovery. So I had enough under my belt, enough self-respect, enough self-esteem, enough service, all of that stuff. And I'd had an attempt at the steps a couple of times, well, three times actually. Three blueprint for progress that did nothing other than just carry on making the story. I was more obsessed with the colour pens I was using, to be honest, than the actual content. And but we started doing long distance, which was really good for me because it meant we could have time together every 4 or 5 weeks for a weekend. And then time apart. And I was raising my 10-year-old son. My daughter had gone abroad at that point. So I threw myself into my step work. And then I really conceded to myself that if I didn't get well, I was going to repeat the same thing. I heard an AA speaker say he thought he'd had 20 relationships and he realised he hadn't had 20 relationships. He'd had one relationship 20 times. And I'd done the same. And so step one, that was hard, but it was a relief. And then I was so grateful that step two was coming. I won't go through all the steps, but at that point, I was suffering from a lot of hypochondria, terrified I was going to get cancer. Didn't really want to talk about that. I was like, I can't really say this to people. But a lot of anxiety, a lot of hypochondria. And I didn't want to go on planes. I didn't like driving through tunnels, on bridges, on motor. I mean, this was untreated alcoholism that just got bigger and bigger and bigger. But I was so desperate, I ended up getting a sponsor in Chicago who I'd never met. And she took me through step work, and so did somebody else in AA using the big book. So things began to change. There was no wiggle room with that, and I had to become accountable. So I ended up doing my fifth step in Chicago. And I got on a plane, and I was terrified to fly, so I took a sponsee and held her hostage in the plane and just sort of put her by the window and did a financial inventory with her for 8 hours straight. But it meant that she got a benefit, so did I. And we got to go to Chicago. And in that time, I got to look at all these things that I was really ashamed of. You know, my dad being mentally ill. He ended up leaving, he became homeless. And I couldn't wait to do these inventories with this sponsor about me. And, you know, somebody said to me, you're going to naturally be a victim. It's quite normal to be a victim until you've done your fifth step. You can't really not be. So here we go. I go into it as a total victim, just saying, and he was homeless and he was out of his mind. And one minute he was gay, the next minute he was on drugs. I mean, it was just chaos. And she just said, what, did you ever get to see him then when he was homeless? Oh, yeah. What, really? And he was never late? No, never. So your dad, even though he's homeless, mentally ill, in and out of psych wards, saw you regularly every single time? Yes. And I began to get a sense of a shift in perspective and can see that this family illness was nobody's fault. And I got to go through those steps and then look at step nine and the harms I'd caused. I'd got done that in step eight. And thank God, by the way. So that fourth step was 534 inventory. I really went overboard with it. But when it came to step eight, I had 300 inventories. I had this sense of responsibility that I'd carried my entire life And thank God for step 8.5. That's a bit like Harry Potter's platform, isn't it? 9¾. This little step, which basically meant I took all these inventories to the person that was helping me. He was actually in AA. And we sat in Victoria Coach Station in Starbucks every Friday night and went through all of them. And the amount of them that just got ripped up. It's not your inventory. It's not your amends to make. So thank God, you know, I could have really injured myself and caused further harm by that. But I got to make amends to my mum and my dad, both of them, for all the harms that I'd caused them. And that was very, very healing. But I couldn't have done it without going through the previous, so I would have just been making it up. I'm sorry, I wouldn't have really gone through all those instances. But I made amends to them, and I then got to make amends just before the COVID lockdown with this ex-partner. You know, he asked to sleep with somebody else. I said, yes. That's a green light. That is a green light, guys. That isn't me saying no. That isn't me saying the fact you've even raised it, that's done for me. Go ahead, feel free. This is finished. Oh, no. I said yes, lied to him, and then punched him in the face and smashed up the kitchen when he came back the following day, and then bad-mouthed him to everybody I possibly could for years until this fifth step, when my sponsor said, okay, so you're a liar then. I was like, yeah, I did lie. And I could take responsibility and think, oh, my God. Yeah, I was like, and I pursued him. And then come to the realisation I didn't actually even like him. That's insanity. I didn't want to marry him. Didn't want that commitment at all. I have two children and a mortgage because that's not really quite... I mean, it's the insanity was off the chart. But then I really got into a routine with steps 10, 11 and 12. And step 10 was just... I still love it. It's absolutely life-changing to look at all those new ideas and those new actions I can take. And... talk about growing. I mean, I really love step 10. It's the one thing that's brought me a tremendous amount of relief and ongoing happiness. After I've got through the shock of the first two columns, then once we get into, you know, new actions I can take, that's brilliant. But just to sort of, for the last bit of what I wanted to share with you, last year, my mum and dad died within 23 weeks of each other. And that was strangely spiritual, is all I can say. It really made me question life, reality, mortality, my soul journey, what am I doing in my life, what am I doing in my recovery. And I was in this really toxic job with a boss who I think could have been alcoholic or child of an alcoholic. It was so familiar to me, and I became utterly obsessed. I mean, you'd think I'd never touched a day's 12-step program in my life. It was all-consuming. And the self-will, I was back into not easy does it again. And I was doing step 10 inventories. I mean, I was taking every bit of action I could. And in March this year, on March the 11th, I resigned from that job. And I'm in the creative industries. I've always been freelance, and this job was a 5-year contract. With a pension. I'd never had a pension. I felt like a grown-up. Never had a pension before. So this was a huge decision after 14 months to say, I'm not doing this. And I just about had enough in me to think, I'm being really abused in this situation. And the reason I can't stand this person is because he's treating me exactly like I treat myself. With no value. I'm shortchanging myself. I'm doing way too much stuff that's not even mine to do. Something's really wrong. So I resigned, and then I went on this complete bender of trying to get more work. Frantically emailing, no responses, nothing. No interviews, no, it was just radio silence. And the fear's kicking in, because I've got the clock ticking. My ego's going absolutely bananas, watching the clock, bean counting. Right, you're now not contributing to your pension. I mean, talk about not living in the day. I was living in my retirement. You know, I mean, that's where I was living, and then we were beyond that, and then we're going to die, and have I made the most of my life? Have I fulfilled my dream? What about my mum and dad? What have they left behind? The legacy. I mean, it was horrendous. And I spoke to a friend in Al-Anon. She said, oh, wow, I can hear loads about ego and nothing about God. And so I'd had that first surrender coming into Al-Anon. I'd had a second emotional surrender with the relationship when I left it, and now we had the big one. For me, was my whole identity, you know, my career, everything. Really happily married with Hamish. We got married, you know, and all of that has been absolutely beautiful. But for me as an Al-Anon member, if my purpose in life is a man, it's going to be really bad for him and really bad for me, because he'll become God. So although I was happily married, absolutely, there was something fundamentally wrong that I really needed to look at. So I began to put the tools into practice, and this friend said nothing about God. So I just said, this is in March the 11th. I just said, right, okay. And then Denbury's text comes in on March the 14th. Hi, I hope this is Andrea. I hope this is the right number. I remember meeting you in Canada, and we've got this convention in September 25th, 26th, whatever. And would you be free to come and share? And it was so out of the blue, I just knew it was a God shot. I mean, I was bleak, even though meetings, you know, I was doing everything I could be doing, but I'd been really unravelled and there was more that was going to get revealed. So this text came in and I spoke with Hamish. I mean, Hamish will sure let you know a bit of his story, but I couldn't speak for both of us. In the past, I would have just gone, does this suit me? Why? Yes, it does. Oh, by the way, you're now coming to Munich. You know, no. Had to press pause. Didn't want to press pause. Just wanted to go, yes, capital letters, shouting caps, emojis all over the place. No. Let's just take it easy here. Easy does it. And so I put some new ideas into practice and we agreed we could come out to the convention. And I remember thinking, I wonder what's going to happen in my life between now and then. Because all I can see is nothing. Nothing. I don't know. I tried to work. I don't know. And all I felt was everything was getting blocked. And that the God of my understanding was going, no, you're going to go through this pain. You're not running away from it. You're not running away from grief or your feelings through work again. Oh, God, it was so painful. But there was a relief in it as well. And we were talking about it earlier. You know, I may not like the wrapping that the gift comes in. So the wrapping was my mum and dad dying, alcoholism, family illness, all of that stuff. The journey I've had with my kids, the wrapping has been really, really tough. But the gift, you know, without any of that, I wouldn't be here. I can't just go and buy a ticket in Heathrow and just say, I'll just buy a ticket and go to Munich and I'll just kind of be here. I have a story. That's the only way I'm here. And I'm so grateful for it today. So I started putting in some new ideas. And the new idea was to actually take the entire summer off. And I lasted about 2 weeks. I started really getting agitated about it. But I did it, and I followed through on it. And what I agreed with Hamish is at the end of the summer, I would then begin to start looking for work. But in the meantime, I was going to really start looking at what my dreams are for me. Because I want to make the absolute most of my life that I've been given freely by my Creator. So the plan was to start looking for part-time work. That was a new idea to me. My ego is, no, I don't want to be a CEO, but I need to be a CEO working in New York. Doing what? I don't know. Not even, anyway, just ego, prestige, property, all of that, and money and finance, all of that stuff. And the answer is no. And I'd read in one of the Al-Anon books that when this person had gone through a big deal, they kept things simple and they got rid of their high-pressure job and took on something part-time. I remember reading that thinking, oh God, I hope that never happens to me. Well, here we are. And I said, right, okay, I'm going to, at some point, start looking for part-time work. But in the meantime, I'm going to follow my dreams and not sabotage my dreams for what I want to do with my skills that I've come to the planet with. I don't want to ignore those anymore. So I spent the summer beginning to experiment with that. And all the teachers started appearing. And I was like, oh, God, okay, this is all happening. And I started doing the thing that I really want to do, and work in Al-Anon is an outside issue, so I'm not going to go into it, much as I would absolutely love to. But I began creating what I wanted to create, and a friend in the meeting where I met Denbury, funny enough, had began to help me outside, blah, blah, blah. Oh, you need to contact this other place in Arizona. So contacted this place and, oh, tell us who you are. Oh, okay. Am I going to be transparent and real and say, this is who I am, this is where I'm at, this is where I would love to be, and this is what I can do at the moment? And I did that and had the most amazing responses, really encouraging. And I've been able to start beginning to put steps in with my recovery and my sponsor and all the rest of it with Easy Does It, rather than this breakneck speed of everything that I do, reacting to phone calls. Right, I'll go to this, I'll do that. You've said, yeah, you're moving in. Okay, fine. And the recovery that I've put into place with Hamish as well. So like I said, we were long distance. So there's an Al-Anon joke. How do you know when an untreated Al-Anon and an untreated alcoholic are dating? Well, there's a removal van outside on the second date. And that's exactly what I did with this other guy. You know, great, I'll move in, girlfriend gone, pregnant, boom, 18 years, nightmare. But straight away, everything. And I know relationships, if they come in real fast, for me, that's a red flag. It's like, well, hang on, I don't need to do that. So with Hamish, I'd like to call you traditional, yes. And then he said, you know, I'd like to see you again. So this is in the August. And I said, I'm not free until January. And I meant it because I had a son, I was a single parent, alternate weekends, there was chaos, his ex-partner was insane, absolutely off his head. And Hamish just said, no pressure. I couldn't believe it. I was like, wow, he's not dependent on me for his self-esteem. That was so attractive. Really attractive. Didn't want him to be dependent on me. And I didn't want to be dependent on him. And so we actually came down to visit. But I'd already gone up to Scotland to meet him. And so when this idea of us meeting up, for my self-esteem, it was, God, it would be so easy to say, I'm going to get on a train. I'm going to get on a train, I'm going to go up there. But the recovery I had was, no, I'm not doing that. I've been to Scotland. If he wants to see me, I hope he'll come down. And he did. And I remember my then sponsor saying, what? He's coming down just to see you. He hasn't got anything else to actually do down there. He's coming down to see you. And not like, you're not worth it, but just like, wow, that's amazing. And I said, yeah, he is. And he came down with a suitcase of gifts. This ex-partner that I had never in 18 years asked me, how are you? Not once. And I remember going to this part-time job where I was working, and that was in Canterbury, and Hamish visited me for the day. Came with me, rather, and took himself off around Canterbury. And I remember coming out of work thinking, I wonder if he'll be there. Because my experience is, the minute you take your eyes off them, they're gone. You know, new woman, pub, whatever, they're gone. You've got to track them. So I came out of work, and there he was, walking up the high street with two big Costa coffees. And he just went, coffee for the lady. And I just thought, how confident is that? He doesn't even know how to take my coffee. But he's not care. He's, you know, probably if I'd said, oh, thanks, but actually I have it, blah, 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 that would probably have been a red flag to him. But he just, he took courage and just said, there's a coffee for the lady. These were such beautiful moments, so luxurious for me, still are. And so, yeah, we began courting, and then after 6 years, he proposed. And I was so grateful that morning that I'd done my prayer and meditation already. It was a Sunday morning. I didn't plan on sharing any of this, by the way. We've already talked about what we were going to share about. But anyway, this is what you're getting. And I'd done my prayer and meditation, and the principle for the day was patience. And I sat, and I'm so glad I'd done my teeth randomly before I'd done my meditation. Anyway, so I sat there with big hair, and he came in, and it was Christmas, and there was a little black box and a silver vase and a red rose, and he came in. And I hadn't noticed him nailed down, but I thought, oh, wow, an early Christmas present, how lovely. And I turned around the other way, and then when I turned around, he was kneeling, and he just said, would you do me the honour of marrying me? And I just said, yes, and I went into such shock, I can't tell you. I mean, I was just utterly shaking, and then we went to his grandmother's party, and I told everybody I could on the way, including the people in Tesco's. I was just going, yeah, you should look at my ring. It was just amazing. But my sponsor, up until that point, had said to me, you're a prize, and don't ever forget it. And don't see it as an arrogant thing. You're a prize, and they need to know it. I had never thought, I'd never had boundaries in relationships, and I'd never wanted any. Because if there's a boundary, that means there's separation. This is how I think. There's separation, that means you're going to go and do something autonomous that's really going to wound me. When this ex-partner had an affair, I honestly felt like my soul had been punched out of me, and I thought I'd probably die. I honestly couldn't handle it, which is why I went back into it. So being proposed to by somebody I absolutely adored, and he adored me, and he wasn't my higher power, I was just like, I'm totally in, 100%. And we've just celebrated our 10-year anniversary, wedding anniversary. Wow. And we had loads of AA and Al-Anon friends there, and I got to wear my wedding dress again and some shoes that looked like Dorothy's slippers. I mean, it was absolutely amazing. I loved it. And I would say yes again today. And we have so much air and freedom. It's so lovely. Somebody today said to me, where's your husband? I went, I don't know. It's all right, I don't know where he is. He's doing his thing. We're at a convention. But just coming up to the total presence, so this part-time work, I'd followed my dreams. I've made it crystal clear to the universe and my creator what I want to do for a living. And I ran it past my sponsor. I thought she was going to tell me to grow up. She didn't. She said, you're already doing that. And I applied for a part-time role. And there were two jobs on offer, one of which isn't absolutely what I would love to do, but it was close enough. And I thought, this is easy, does it? I can do close enough. And I went to the interview on Wednesday. We flew here on Thursday. And in the interview, she said, oh, I've looked at your website and it's really exciting. So instead of those two jobs on offer, would you like this job? And it's the title of what I want to do. And I just said, yes. And I just knew God was in the middle. And in the interview, I'd also spoken about my dad and his mental illness and his deafness, because it's kind of relevant. I've never revealed myself like that in an interview and been completely authentic. So I got home to pack. They said, what are you doing this afternoon? I went, packing to go to Bavaria. And they went, wow, have an amazing time. What are you doing, skiing? No, hot chocolate and fresh air, meeting friends. You know, just sort of navigate that. And they rang 4 hours later and said, we would love you to work with us. And that happened. And anyway, so it's just for 4 days. It's a four-day block in October. And again, that's easy does it in a small step. And if the whole team works, then it will then go into more work. And I've got tools now, if it's manageable or not. But Al-Anon hasn't given me my life back. The life I've described to you, I can't imagine any one of us would want, but most of us have probably had. I haven't had my old life back. I absolutely do not want it. But I can honestly say that I am Andrea, first and foremost, and I'm Hamish's wife, which I am so proud to be. But I am Andrea, and I am on this soul search now, which I wasn't expecting. So I've been in Al-Anon 24 years, and more gets revealed, deeper and deeper understanding. So that's what's happened to me since Denbury's text came in. And then that was the result the day before we flew out. So I knew something was going to happen, but I've just had to have faith, really, this year, because some days it's just been utterly terrifying. Regardless of how much program I've got under my belt, I'm still alive, and it's a daily reprieve, which means I'm not cured. So I am so happy to be here. I was saying to Heidi, I've watched Heidi as a kid, always wanted to be Heidi, and here we are. I might wear plaits tomorrow. Anyway, thank you for allowing me to share and be here.